Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is David Krakauer, the greatest klezmer clarinetist in the world. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our Shinchinim, Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This time of year is a very special period on the Jewish calendar. The 6 weeks from Tisha B'Av, the fast day of the ninth of Av, through Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. We began last Saturday night and Sunday with one of the low moments in our people's long history, perhaps the lowest, the tragic Ninth of Av commemoration, recalling the destruction of the First and Second Temples and the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. We now move into a period of consolation and comfort, all of it leading to the month of Elul, a time of spiritual preparation and anticipation that builds up to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the Jewish High Holy Days. Each of these 6 weeks, we chant a special Haftarah in the synagogue, a selection from the prophet's second Isaiah. Unlike many prophecies in the Bible, these are all upbeat passages that assure us of our continual capacity to return to God and of God's eternal desire to welcome us back. The images Isaiah uses are beautiful. He was a truly great poet, and he reminds us of the constancy of God's love and of our mission as Jews. I called you in righteousness, have taken you by the hand, kept you, made you a covenant people, a light to the nations, to open the blind eyes, to bring out prisoners from the dungeons, those who sit in darkness out of the prison house. Fear not, for I have redeemed you, you are mine forever. These prophetic haftarot of consolation remind us that God can be the source of support and consolation in our own lives. The lessons of these texts are simple but powerful. The promise of return, tshuvah, is always present. The possibility to change our lives for the better, to change the world for the better, is constantly available. God stands ready to welcome us back to the best version of ourselves that we can be. This is a good time of year to begin to become aware of the extraordinary potential we, each of us, possess to improve. Now, in this hot summer period and in the coming days of preparation and exaltation into the fall, we have the opportunity to act to realize that great potential. May this unique, unusual period of the year prove to be a time of growth and awareness for you, for your family, for your friends, for all you care about. To play us in on this, summer morning, here's our guest, David Krakauer, the amazing klezmer clarinetist, playing Hesar Bulgar with the WDR Big Band. Thank you. That was our guest this morning, David Krakauer, greatest living klezmer clarinetist, foremost practitioner of the most important Jewish instrument of all. We caught up with David Krakauer at the Krakow Jewish Festival recently. In a moment, meet him and find out not only how and why he makes such amazing Jewish music, but a great deal more about music and its role in shaping Jewish identity. All that when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish David Krakauer. He is, oh, I don't know, in my opinion, the greatest klezmer clarinetist in the world and a wonderful musician. Met him here at the Krakow Jewish Festival. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Morning, Sam. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Tell us, who are your greatest influences on clarinet and who helped you develop, either listening to or personally, the style that you've created?
Have several hours. We can talk about it. But, no, you know, I grew up hearing a lot of classical music in my home. My late mother was a professional classical violinist and teacher. And so her gods were the violin gods like Fritz Kreisler and Misha Elman and
Yasha Heifetz,
yeah. Joseph Szigeti, the violinists from the past. And, you know, it was interesting. My mom always said to me, when you hear those violinists, you can tell them apart. You hear one note of Kreisler, you can tell, oh, it's Kreisler, or it's Elman, or it's Szigeti. These days, it's harder. I mean, I think it's just education. The pedagogy has become so advanced that a lot of things are homogenized. But, you know, then I grew up with this concept from a very early age. Then I started getting into jazz, and I fell in love with the music of Sidney Bechet when I was 11 years old. And I heard his soprano saxophone and clarinet playing, and I was like, wow, this guy is so amazing and so personal. And again, it's drop the needle, so to speak. It dates me.
Well, you know, all of us a little bit.
But, I mean, well, vinyl's coming back. Now.
It has, in a
so
big way.
People love those needles again. But you know, you hear 2 seconds of Sidney Bechet, and you know that it's Sidney Bechet. And so, of course, I was listening to him, and then that listening branched out into all aspects of jazz, and I started really getting into like the Duke Ellington band and all the great soloists, like Johnny Hodges, the saxophone player, and then, of course, the brass players, Cootie Williams and Tricky Sam Nanton, Ben Webster on tenor sax, Coleman Hawkins, the great, you know, then going into Coleman Hawkins and John Coltrane.
The gods of saxophone.
Charlie Parker, right. Louis Armstrong, you know, great, of course, great iconic trumpet player and singer. And so, you know, all of these influences of jazz really were so important to me. And that idea to have an individual voice stuck with me as my life's goal. And I feel very fortunate, I guess, that I was able to achieve that, that somehow when I started to play klezmer, because that's, you know, a whole other thing.
Yeah.
I was playing jazz in my teenage years, and then when I was about 20, I abandoned jazz because I was afraid that I would never find that individual voice, that I'd be a kind of a very good mimic. So I abandoned jazz, got into classical music, did about a 10-year career freelancing in New York, I was playing contemporary music with all the different groups. I was playing principal clarinet in orchestras. I played in a woodwind quintet that won the Naumburg Chamber Music Award. Then when I was about 30 years old, I felt like I had thrown the baby out with the bathwater. I was yearning to improvise again, to play off-the-page music, to get into something, and again, to find that creativity and maybe give it a shot again to find my own individual
voice. Find your
voice
and do it in a more personal way.
Yes, exactly. So I got into, through a series of chance meetings and coincidences in New York City, I started to run into people who were doing Eastern European Jewish klezmer. And I thought, wow, this would be a great way to kind of connect with my Jewishness, because honestly speaking, I had my bar mitzvah, and the next day I pressed the delete button. I was on to Charlie Parker, you know. And my parents said, get your bar mitzvah to please your grandparents, and it wasn't, you know,
such an American story, right?
It's a classic American story. But then I thought, this would be a great way to connect to my cultural heritage in my own way, on my own terms. And so I started to study the recordings of Dave Tarras, of Naftuli Brandwine, really study those, and learning note for note countless klezmer tunes, and learning about the ornamentation and the sound.
The dreidlach, as
yeah,
you say. You
know. All the different rules and regulations of playing correctly, stylistically.
Right, what sounds really like klezmer and what doesn't.
Exactly.
Right.
And what was interesting was then, after several months, a band called the Klezmatics heard about me, and I started playing with them, and suddenly we went to Germany, to Berlin, played a big festival, and there were 1,000 screaming, yelling, dancing, partying Europeans, not necessarily Jewish. And I thought,
mostly not Jewish.
Mostly not Jewish, although a lot of Jews
of
were coming out of the woodwork.
Yes.
You know, at that time, this was like 1989, 1990.
Yeah, right after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And,
yes.
You know, now it's okay again.
Exactly.
Of communism.
Yes, yes. That whole thing. I mean, I realize, you know, that it was no coincidence that I got into klezmer at that time, looking back on it. In the late 80s, the mid-80s, of course, there was Perestroika, the softening of Eastern Europe. We started to read literature from Poland, like Ferdydurk by Gombrowicz, that celebrating, I just saw a poster here in Krakow that Ferdydurk is celebrating its 75th anniversary. Hmm. So this is this piece of classic literature in Poland, which was banned, of course, because it was a satirical, crazy thing. Then Philip Roth put it out in his Writers from the Other Europe series. So we were reading Ferdydurk, we're reading Bruno Schulz, of course, then Milan Kundera became so popular. And so that was happening, and this glimmer of this opening Eastern Europe. I was playing in an avant-garde band in the late 80s with my friend Anthony Coleman, this composer, pianist, great, incredible musician, and we were playing jazz together in high school, and then in the late 80s I played in his project called By Night, which was a kind of a fake Eastern European lounge band, you know, the idea was you'd be in the middle of Yugoslavia at that time,
right.
And you'd go into some club and there would be a band at 3 a.m. playing some really strange music.
Strange stuff.
And that was
this is almost like Wild and Crazy Guys. Fascinating. We're going to have to pick this up with David Krakauer, the great klezmer clarinetist, when we continue in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Good morning. Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Now, you are just back from Israel, and you often go. I was thinking about an interesting situation. People live so close to the border. I know we have some new Shin Shinim, one of whom comes, we were talking offline, off air, from Moshav.
Right, like Netiv Asara.
Yeah, right on the border of Gaza. And there are Israelis who live in the West Bank, in Judea and Samaria, who, why would you choose to live in an area in which it's not only possible, but pretty likely that you're going to get hit by rockets or kite bombs or rock throwing or some kind of potential terrorist attack? Why live so close to the area of danger?
So you see, there are Israelis who live in Israel, and every piece of land is the country, and they live wherever they want to live. Now, if you talk about this Moshav, beautiful place, near the ocean,
right?
Okay, really
right.
Close to. So the quality of life, I guess, is something that draws people over there. It's cheaper.
Much cheaper.
Yeah,
you get a big home.
Be in Tel Aviv.
Yeah, if you're in Tel Aviv, you maybe could afford a tiny apartment here. You
right,
can have
a villa, a house,
backyard.
It's true. And it's a small community as well, you know, Moshav. So we talk about a couple of hundreds, that's it, you know, families. So they know each other. So it's like a very strong sense of community. Speaking about that Moshav, interesting enough is that many of the community members there actually lived in Sinai Desert. So they lived in Sinai, like in Yamit, when Israel signed a peace agreement
with Egypt, gave back the Sinai.
So they had to move into Israel, right?
Wow.
That was Israel too, but they moved into the land of Israel. And so it's their home. It really is their home. So
fascinating. You know, I mean, we think about Israel you see on the news, it's always dangerous, it's terrorist. It's not true. Most parts of Israel feel very safe, very comfortable. But there are areas, where in order to drive in and out, you need to have, screens, metal screens on the windshields of your car and on your windows so you don't get a rock thrown through it. And people make a choice to live there. Now, for some of them, as you noted, it's a choice of this has always been our area, or it's a sense of, this is economically more viable. But for some people, it is ideological, isn't it?
Absolutely, of course. I mean, we have those who, strongly believe that this is the part of our history, and this is where King David resigned, and this is where he lived. And
Hebron, the first capital of Israel.
Obviously, right. And Sarah,
right.
Our ancestors,
Right.
And obviously, there's ideology reasons too. And what you said before, every time I lead a trip to Israel, people ask me about safety, and I'm always honest. I say, look, I lived here for 25 years. It's a long time. 25 years.
Makes you an American almost. Huh?
Absolutely. And then, I went many times with my own family, my wife and my two sons. They've been there so many times. And I would never go to a place where I feel unsafe. And we do feel safe there.
Right. Thanks so much, Amir. We'll talk next week. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, there is a weird follow-up to the story not terribly long ago in which an Israeli won the Eurovision contest, and they've won a few times before, and Netta Barzilai, and the contest is always held in the next year in the country of the winner. It's going to be in 2019, this big Eurovision Song Contest in Israel, and they want to hold it in Jerusalem, which of course provoked controversy. And the Turkish prime minister, who is really not the prime minister, he's probably the puppet of Erdogan, the president and near dictator now of Turkey, said the whole thing was a fake. Israel was fraudulently won it. And Israelis can't sing, they can only kill. Israel and Turkey for a long time had close relations. It's been rocky for a while, but this is really kind of ugly now.
It's ugly and it's complicated on several levels. First of all, Eurovision is kind of a misleading name because it is about singing, not about vision. I have no idea why the contest is called Eurovision, mm-hmm. but it's a well-known contest, and a lot of ugly sides of nationalism, the worst form of patriotism, show themselves during the course of this competition. So Israel won, not for the first time, as you point out, and the Turkish prime minister, presumably voicing the thoughts and feelings of his boss, but we don't know that for sure, made these nasty remarks. So how do you put that in context? Well, the party in power in Turkey now is a populist right-wing party.
Kind of Islamist?
Supported by fundamentalists and basically old traditional Islamic peasants from central Anatolia who have moved into big cities but don't really feel comfortable there and who aren't part of the cosmopolitan urban culture that characterizes cities in the west of Turkey, particularly Istanbul, Izmir, and others, which for centuries have been cosmopolitan melting pots and very tolerant of all kinds of things.
And very heterogeneous and mixed populations of all kinds and lots of people doing all kinds of really good things.
Right. So Turkish Jews still celebrate bar and bat mitzvahs in big fancy hotels in Istanbul. They still have weddings. They still run a big, beautiful day school with heavy security. Are they afraid? Probably more now than they were 10 years ago, but not enough to be leaving en masse for Israel or Canada or anywhere else. Do they have the financial ability to leave? Certainly. Can they still thrive in the Turkish business community? Absolutely. Does Erdogan or this prime minister say or do other things that are equally sort of pig-headed and obnoxious? Absolutely. But, you know, historically, Turks and Arabs have never been friends. And this is a chance for Turkey, at almost no cost to itself, to improve its standing in the Arab world by appearing to be a champion of Palestinian rights and caring about their Arab neighbors, which pretty clearly, both historically and today, in spite of the common religion, they don't get along well with Arabs or their Arab neighbors.
Yeah, it's there was a lot of positive energy in the Israel-Turkey relationship for a long time and a lot of cooperation, and it's hard to see that coming back into play.
Well, if Erdogan and his party are ever elected out of power, that will resume.
Nearly happened in that coup a couple of years ago, but not so likely now. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, Tamir Shakuri and Khendinachi. Welcome for one of your last visits here on Too Jewish.
Hello.
So you guys have been working hard, as always, promoting Israel here in America on behalf of the Weintraub Israel Center. And you just finishing up camp with a bunch of American Jewish kids. Tell us a little bit about, you know, your thoughts as you reach the conclusion of this summer camp experience. A day camp, I should note, not an overnight camp.
So we tried to bring Israel as much as possible to camp. It is a very good camp, and we just thought that what will make it even better is the fact that Israel will be incorporated in it. And so we did a word of the day every single morning.
So Hebrew word of the day?
Yeah, we even have
What was your word today?
Song. Today was Ruach HaSport, because we started Maccabi a week. And sport is like...
It's a term. It's a bitui. It's not just a milah.
Yep. So sport is already like, they know it. So I gave myself the Ruach Ha to teach them. And
the spirit of sport.
Yeah, because it's Maccabiah, so they need to have the right spirit.
And for those of you who don't know, Maccabiah is kind of, the Olympics.
The Jewish Olympics.
Camp, Jewish Olympics, right?
Yeah. So we try to incorporate Israel through the words of the day. And we try to teach like how to count in Hebrew so that counselors can count in Hebrew, count their kids.
I should note that you have orange paint on your face and legs as part of the Maccabiah.
Mm-hmm. Very into Maccabiah. Maccabiah is a great week where you really go all out and participate in many different competitions that are meant to teach kids how to really be good sports, but also get them in the vibe of like how to win, how to lose, and get all everyone's like
how to be good teammates too, right?
How to be
support one another, be loyal.
Yeah, and to teach them that, you know what, this guy might not be the best runner, but he's really good at like eating crackers and whistling after, or I don't know. Yeah.
Some other sports. So,
yeah, some Chen, other stuff, yeah.
Yeah, it was a great, great experience. Chen, your last thought, your thoughts on the conclusion of camp?
Well, we also did Israel Day, which was a lot of fun. I feel like a lot, I did cooking, so.
Bishul.
So and all of my recipes were somehow related to Israel, or most of them were Israeli, but some of them were in some weird ways related to Israel, because Israeli cuisine is quite limited. But I think the kids learned a lot about different foods, and even if they like went home and were like, I like Israeli salad, to their parents, like,
sure.
I've done my part. And I think they had a great time, and they all, every single lesson I would remind them like, hey, do we have any new kids? Like, do you guys know where I'm from? And so they like all remember a smiley face from Israel. So hopefully they all feel like they have a friend in Israel, which is just a purpose of this program, like in general. And I feel like camp really gives you a good platform to do that. I also feel like the kids like get a lot out of it, and even if it's just like, I don't know, cupcakes, they still like get to build relationships with each other. And like I think it's like a great thing, and I also have never experienced that, because in Israel we don't have that platform. So it was really cool to like see an American summer camp.
It's great. Thank you, guys. We will talk next week for the last time for who knows how long. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A priest, a preacher, and a rabbi meet for lunch regularly. All agree that preaching to people isn't really so hard. Human beings are easy to persuade. A real challenge would be to successfully preach to a bear. So the three clergy decide to go to the woods, find a bear, preach to him, and attempt to convert him. They will then reunite for their regular lunch and compare notes. Well, at the next lunch, Father Flanagan comes in with his arm in a cast, and he says, I read to the bear from the catechism. Well, that bear was tough. He started to fling me round and broke me arm, but I quickly sprinkled him with holy water. He became docile as a sweet lamb. Next week, he'll be taking his first Holy Communion. Well, Reverend Billy Bob, the pastor, is in worse shape than the priest. He has to use crutches to come in, and he says, I read to the bear from God's holy word. We wrestled and wrestled. It got pretty tough. But when we end up pert near a creek, I quick shoved him in the water, baptized him, and the change was a miracle. We spent the rest of the day testifying and praising the Lord. He has joined my flock now for sure. The priest and pastor then turned to the rabbi. He's in a full body cast. Oy, says the rabbi, so new. Maybe circumcision wasn't the right place to start. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. You know, we always start with circumcision. And now a word of Torah. As a people, we Jews are good at many things. Fetching, of course. Lashon hara, gossip, telling people things we shouldn't. And eating, I guess. Perhaps most importantly, Jews are good at asking questions. In fact, the greatest of all Jewish questions is asked in this week's Torah portion of Akev, third Sedra in the book of Deuteronomy. It reads, Ve'ata Yisrael, ma Adonai shoel me'imach? Now, Israel, what does God ask of you? Huh, what does God ask of you indeed? Akev answers this great question, that you have awe of the Lord your God, walk in all of God's ways and love God, serve the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. The big question, what does God ask of you? And Akev's answer begin a series of statements in Jewish tradition, attempts to distill from our large moral storehouse just what the essence, the ikar of Jewish ethics really is. What is it that God wants? What's the true standard we need to uphold to be considered morally good? Akev lists a few things we must do for God's sake. First, revere God. Second, walk in God's ways. Third, love God. And fourth, serve God with our hearts and souls. Fifth and finally, we're told that we must guard and do the mitzvot, the commandments of God. It's a clear list, but it was the beginning, not the conclusion of this exploration. 500 years after Deuteronomy was completed, the great prophet Isaiah distilled these terse commands into a more concise version in last week's Haftarah. Cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, relieve the oppressed, uphold the orphan's rights, take up the widow's cause. A century later, the prophet Micah refined the formula further. He asked, "What does God seek of you? Only to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God." Finally, Hillel, 400 years later still, just over 2,000 years ago now, said it most concisely, "Do not do to others what is hateful to yourself. All the rest is commentary. Now, go and learn." The Jewish assumption is that you will adopt one of these magnificent formulas in your own life. Whichever one you choose, it will be a high standard for how to live, but one that anyone can achieve if he or she chooses to do so. After all, it's what God wants, and so should we. When we return here on To Jewish, our guest, the great klezmer clarinetist David Krakauer, will tell us who his own musical inspirations were. Don't miss this great musician and Jewish thinker when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The Israeli nation-state basic law that passed the Knesset last week continues to stir up controversy around the world. The law officially affirms Israel is a Jewish nation-state, something everyone else has known and said for 70 years, but is apparently much exercised about right now. But there's much more here than a public confirmation of a seven-decade-old fact. In order to understand the furor surrounding the new basic law, a few basic facts have to be absorbed. First, like many nations around the world, including England, Israel does not actually have a constitution. This is often hard for Americans to understand. We have had a constitution as our basic law of the land since the year 1789, but that is not a given for all other democracies. In the case of the State of Israel, in the absence of a formal constitution, the legal system is founded on a series of what are known as basic laws. These laws address topics that range from the way the Israeli government is structured and how elections are conducted to the affirmation of basic human rights and dignity for all citizens, including the right to work. And they include the legal basis for the military, judiciary, and administrative aspects of the nation. They define Jerusalem as Israel's capital, that goes back to 1980, and protect the religious rights of all people. In effect, the basic laws are a de facto functional form of a constitution. Now, virtually every document that created the State of Israel in 1948, including, of course, the original Declaration of Independence, says that Israel is the name of the country and it is a Jewish state, the only one on the planet, and the first time a Jewish state has existed since the first century CE. But those statements were never made part of the basic laws, which require a large majority of the Knesset to approve them in order to become more than just ordinary laws that can be changed by a simple majority. The basic laws are more durable and influential than other laws, kind of like the way we look at constitutional provisions or the amendments like the Bill of Rights. The nation-state basic law in Israel that passed last week by a supermajority of the Knesset, but was not passed unanimously, by the way, the vote was 62-55 with two abstentions, Anyway, most of its provisions, well, really all of them, are purely symbolic. They acknowledge such things as the blue and white design of the Israeli flag with a Jewish star, or the state symbol, the menorah, or the national anthem, Hatikvah. They say that the official language of Israel is Hebrew, but that Arabic has a special high status, that Saturday is the day off for Shabbat, that Israel uses both the Hebrew Jewish calendar and the Gregorian one used by nearly everybody else, and they affirm the national holidays of Israel. And the nation-state basic law affirms the Jewish character of the Jewish state while guaranteeing the rights of all citizens. It is this last aspect of the law that has provoked controversy not only outside of Israel but within it. Some minorities that have faithfully served in the Israeli military and the government, like the Druze, feel as though they might now be considered second-class citizens with these provisions that have been made official basic laws. Many Jewish Israelis, both on the left, of course, but also on the right, like Benny Begin and Israel's president, Reuven Rivlin, are concerned about balancing Israel's Jewish and democratic principles, since Israel is both Jewish and the only true democracy in a very undemocratic part of the world. To be honest, at a time in history when democracy is under attack worldwide in a variety of countries, Turkey, the Philippines, Hungary, and Poland come to mind immediately, Italy is teetering, and you can make a case for the shakiness of democracy in the U.S. these days, in our presidential elections and elsewhere, well, this rather benign Israeli nation-state basic law does not seem to merit deep reason for concern. But this being Israel, where every issue grows out of all proportion and nothing is ever taken in context, it has certainly provoked a lot of angst, especially now internationally. Some of this was expressed in a troubling story this past week. The Jerusalem Report, the news magazine published by Israeli daily The Jerusalem Post, last week fired illustrator Avi Katz after a cartoon of his mocked an image of Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and Likud lawmakers taking a selfie. The cartoon, a play on George Orwell's famed political book Animal Farm, depicted Netanyahu and Likud officials as pigs, with Orwell's thematic political slogan from the book above them, "All pigs are equal, but some are more equal than others." It was a play on that selfie taken by Likud and Netanyahu. An obvious shot at the nation-state law, this is the kind of political cartoon that shouldn't have provoked any kind of firing, especially at a country famous for open, vigorous debate and vivid political exchange. But in the overheated world of Israeli politics, perhaps we now have the first casualty of a new and more repressive national environment, and it was a clever cartoonist, not the editor who ran the cartoon, of course, by the way. This is becoming a very, very weird world. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, David Krakauer, the best klezmer clarinetist in the world, in my opinion, and not just mine, met here at the Krakow Jewish Festival, the largest Jewish festival in Europe, one of the largest in the world, if not the largest. And we're talking about the influences on his development. And we spoke earlier in the show, and you talked about how you went deeply into jazz and then tried to find your own voice when you turned about 30 in Eastern European music. It almost got up to the time when you first came to the Krakow Jewish Festival. I think we got to about 1990 or so.
Yeah, right.
Tell us how that evolved and how klezmer has become so focal for you.
Well, just to quickly finish up my other story, when I started playing with the klezmatics in the early 90s, we would play a lot of weddings, and people would come up to me of a certain age. This was in the early 90s. They might have been in their 60s or 70s, and they said to me, Dave Tarras played at my bar mitzvah, and you sound just like Dave Tarras. Now, I knew I didn't sound just like Dave Tarras because I purposely wanted to find my own sound. I was purposely letting it mutate and letting all the influences kind of mixed together. You can hear the difference of my playing from December of 1990 on Rhythm and Jews to Jews with Horns, also with the Klezmatics, in the mid-90s, like 1994.
One of my all-time favorite album titles, and I love the Klezmatics. I've brought them out in the past when I've in my synagogue. But that Jews with Horns is just great.
Oh, well, thank you, thank you. So anyway,
but you're right, your playing has changed.
My playing has changed, and that, you know, evolved. And so then suddenly, my dream to find my own voice came true. I found my own voice. I know that people tell me, you know, you hear on the radio, you hear three notes, and that's David Krakauer. So that I was very pleased with that, you know. But so it's still in this early area of my development, we got an invitation to come with the Klezmatics. I was still with the Klezmatics in the summer of 1992 to come to the Krakow Jewish Culture Festival. And of course, there's a famous story that, you know, I was introduced to the audience. And Janusz, you know, as Janusz Makuk, as he introduces each person by name in every band, I came up to the microphone and I said, "My name is David Krakauer and welcome to my city." And people freaked out and still remember that.
Well, and?
Well, you know, yes, and it is. I mean, I've been back countless times. I don't even remember how many times I've been back, but probably a good 15 to 20 times in the last, you know, 25 years.
So your family must have come from here, no?
Well, you know, there's that old saying that, you know, if you're named Krakauer or Warschauer or Lublin or Slobin or something, you didn't come from that place. Your immediate family didn't come from that place, but it goes further back.
Yeah, well, sure. A few generations, anyway.
So my great-grandfather came from Bielsk-Podlavsky, which is actually in the north. There's also a Bielsk in the south.
Right.
But he
came from the north.
He came from the north, near Bialystok.
Mm-hmm. By the way, my family came from near Bialystok, too, near Krynki, which is pretty close to them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We're Lantzmen in some sense or another,
totally,
I'm sure.
Oh, totally. And so probably, you know, when they were given out so-called Christian names,
last names
for taxation purposes, they said, oh, those people came from Krakow, but they were probably living in the Bialystok area. But,
right.
But so they're the Krakauers. There must have been some kind of a lineage thing.
Well, it doesn't matter at this point, because now you're so closely identified. It is your city.
It is, yes.
You've come, as you said, a number of times since 1992.
Yes.
Tell us about the changes you've seen in this incredible Jewish festival.
Well, the festival has...
And in Krakow itself, of course.
Yeah. Well, when I came to Krakow, it was a ruin. And it was the Kazimierz was a... I mean, not the whole city.
And Kazimierz, of course, is the Jewish area. It was the historic Jewish center of Krakow.
Yes. So that area, you could see the scars of the war, you could see the scars of communism, you could see places where families had been ripped from their homes, traces of mezuzahs that were
taken
removed. It was so incredible. There was a piece of the ghetto wall, which was just somebody's garden wall, was left maybe, I don't know, I'm not great with it, like 100 meters long. I mean, a rather large piece. There is a memorial piece of the ghetto wall,
right,
in the former ghetto across the river from the Jewish quarter. And it was built by the Nazis in the shape of Jewish gravestones as a Nazi joke.
Yeah.
And so... when I saw that piece of the wall, which is not, unfortunately, not available because it was somebody's private property, but the gate was kind of open and I went in with somebody who was in the know and I was able to see it. And when I saw that piece of the wall, I broke down weeping. I mean, that, for me, you know, you can go to museum after museum, you can read book after book, but when you see something that's, you know, a tangible object that was made with such a cruel and horrific intent, you know, that's where one receives the emotional, you know, payload. When I was in Birkenau, the things that also were so moving were, and moving and horrific and hit you right in the solar plexus, were like these things where it would say, you know, with the du form in German with the big Gothic letters, gestattet dich ruhig, keep yourselves, in like talking to a child, keep yourselves silent. Wasser trinken verboten, water drinking forbidden. These things painted on the walls of the crumbling barracks in Birkenau. That, to me, yes, you see the room full of shoes, you see the room full of suitcases. Room full of human hair. It's
horrific.
It's horrific, but somehow those things, the little cruelties that you can imagine on a day-to-day basis, the humiliation, I think that really hit me. In a huge way. So, but the first year I came to Krakow, I couldn't go to Auschwitz. I couldn't bring myself to go. I didn't have time. I didn't want to hop on a tour bus. I wasn't going to go there. And finally, several years later, maybe even 5 or 6 years later, I found a person who was part of a group of young people I had taught up in the north, actually, who I'm working with now, the Saini Klezmer Band. And this was a young woman who was part of that crowd. And Saini, I said, would you take me and a group of us to Auschwitz, you know, and we took the train. I felt that was the only honest way to go to Auschwitz. Couldn't go in a tour bus, you know. We took the train, we were silent, we went, we saw it, we came back silently. It was remarkable.
I have one more question, and it has to do with, speaking as a cantor personally, klezmer is improvisational in nature. It's group improvisation, but it's also solo improvisation worked into the group, which I guess is like jazz. Always seems to me when I listen to great klezmer clarinetists that it's like listening to great chazonim. Do you ever cross over and listen to people who don't play clarinet? I mean, do you listen to some of the improvisational stuff? Do you steal stuff from cantors too?
I don't really.
It's a very, very selfish question here.
Well, but. I don't steal stuff from cantors.
Steal is a bad word.
No. I steal plenty. But, No. In other words, of course, I listen to violinists.
Cantors do too, of course.
No, but I mean, I think that you know what I mean. What I mean by that is that I did not really study Chazanut really, you know, carefully, but you know, I've listened to Yossele Rosenblatt, I've listened to, you know, the great cantors of the past.
This feels to me like Pinchik would be a good place to steal if you're playing clarinet.
Yeah,
just, you know,
right. You know, and
Rosenblatt too.
You know, and just like that intuitively, I know that of course the Chazanut is so intertwined with klezmer music, and they would say that, you know, with Doinas, that in Romania the cantors were influenced by the shepherds, and the shepherds were influenced by the cantors.
Yeah.
And you know, nobody could really tell the difference. It was again an intertwined kind of
situation.
Except
the cantors were much worse at taking care of sheep, I suspect.
Right. Cantors, they didn't mess with that. But you know, many cantors have told me, Jack Mendelssohn notably, but many other cantors have said to me, David, you touch that thing. You figured it out somehow. You touch that Pintali Yid in Chazanut. So, you know, while...
You have kavana, you know, as we say. You have that ability, that sort of religious interpretation, that concentration of the heart in your music.
I think that I feel that music, coming from my mom, who was a very emotional player and really defended that so fiercely. You know, it's like, it's not about the notes. It's about conveying an emotion. And from hearing Bechet and Coltrane and Louis Armstrong and what that makes me feel, and then playing klezmer music, it's, yeah, it's not about playing some notes. It's about having a sound that makes people feel something, you know, that penetrates people's nervous systems, that makes them vibrate. And that's what a great cantor does. You know, I've heard cantors, you know, and they just kind of sing, you know, and I'm like, you know.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily being a cantor. It's like getting into the right. Kishkas of Chazanut and what that means. And then when you can, like, whoa, that took me to another place.
Right.
That levitation that one needs to find in music. So I've always felt that's important, but it's always been intuitive for me. I never sat and studied Chazanut, you know,
sure.
In detail, but just listening and you know, I think Aaron Lebedev is also kind of a Chazan in his own way. I mean, he really
Romania.
Sorry, yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
No, I think. I want to thank David Krakauer, who always takes us to an extraordinary place musically and spiritually in his work, for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Well, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure, and I hope we have a chance to do this again.
I would love to anytime.
Thank you. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out from David Krakauer.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guests will be Amy Israel Pregelman and John Pregelman, founders of Kavod, an organization that works to ensure dignity for all Holocaust survivors. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes, of course, from David Krakauer, our guest this morning, playing a cut called Elijah Walks from his Ancestral Groove album. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.